Stay tuned now on 1460 WVOX for The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin. The Ballot Box is a monthly program brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Now, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Good morning, and welcome to The Ballot Box. We're a production of the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, hosted by our hometown station, WVOX Radio. I'm Tamar Tate, and I'm here with my co-host, Nita Lubin. So, let's begin. This is the first post-election show of The Ballot Box, and what an election it was. More Americans voted in the 2020 election than in any other election in more than 100 years. This unprecedented turnout is a testament both to the determination of the American voters and also to the hard work of the League of Women Voters in registering, informing, and protecting voters all across the country and right here in New Rochelle. I know here in New Rochelle, the League was out in full force registering new voters, especially on local college campuses, facilitating virtual candidate forums. They were providing candidate and ballot information to voters through voter guides and vote411.org. Poll monitors. They launched the League of Women Voters Youth Corps. They were very busy. Despite the challenges of the COVID-19 epidemic, members of the League were out in full force and were very, very grateful.
Exactly right, Tamar. We are also appreciative that the great state of New York took several steps to make voting easier this year. And these came on top of the fact that early voting had been passed at the state level last year and was being implemented in a presidential election for the first time in New York. And also, Tamar, let's add our thanks to all Election 2020 poll workers. As always, it couldn't have been done without them, but this year it took just a bit more pandemic-related courage to do the job. So among the folks being thanked, every poll worker.
Absolutely. So Nina, did you take advantage of the early voting?
I absolutely did. Our family voted early, and I know that yours did as well.
Yeah.
How are you doing, Tamar?
Crazy lines, or not so bad?
We had an interesting experience. We actually went directly to the Westchester Board of Elections before early polling began. We went to the window and asked for our absentee ballots. We went out to the parking lot, filled out our absentee ballots, walked right back in, and turned them in. So we were done and done very early.
Yep, that beats me. Although
that would do it.
Stories, some people were in line for hours.
I
didn't have it so bad. I went early, but midweek, not with the first rush, and I only waited a half hour. But it's interesting. Along with this election has just come this flood of disinformation, especially efforts to sow doubt about the outcome. Well, misinformation of all kinds, not just about the elections, had already been on the rise globally. This had been compounded by the pandemic and stay-at-home orders that caused more people, including myself, to be glued to their screens, consuming social media. And understanding how misinformation and intentionally propagated disinformation spreads is a topic that we're going to be focusing on this morning.
Our guest today is Andy Cattell. Andy has a rather intimate relationship with language. He is a professional communicator, and his career has spanned communicating as a journalist, in public relations, and from within corporate America. At his retirement last year, Andy wrote in a letter to colleagues and friends that he was committed to using the skills he's honed over the years to help make the world a better place. And that is exactly what he is doing. One of the areas he's targeted is increasing our news literacy, that is, combating fake news, or as Andy will explain, disinformation, false information, deliberately spread to influence public opinion or hide the truth. As Tamar noted, disinformation is now a regular feature of daily life in both print and online media. It poses a challenge for each of us. For the League of Women Voters, whose mission is citizen education, the fact that the League's main textbook, The News of the Day, is no longer reliable is chilling. All of us need to understand what disinformation is, where it comes from, and how to combat it. And Andy has taken on this challenge.
Well, let me just give you a little quick background information on Andy. Andy joined the League of Women Voters of Westchester in 2019 to lead and co-lead workshops for the public designed to make them better news consumers. In teaching people how to tell the difference between fake and real news, Andy draws on a career that, as Nina described, spanned almost four decades in international and domestic journalism, public relations, and corporate communications. Andy is a graduate of Syracuse University with dual degrees in broadcast journalism and Russian language, and he studied Russian at Leningrad State University in the USSR, as well as at Middlebury College. As an editor and reporter at the Associated Press for 14 years, Andy covered Mikhail Gorbachev's transformation of the Soviet Union, conflict resolution at the UN, state news in West Virginia, and national news for AP's broadcast newswire. During a 10-year career at Fleischmann Hillard PR agency, Andy created a Russia-focused communications practice, and he was a consultant to companies as diverse as Exxon, Alcan, Foster Grant, PepsiCo. And then taking a deeper dive into corporate America, Andy joined GE in 2004 as lead communicator of the company's energy investing arm, managing communications connected with global energy projects worth billions of dollars related to conventional and renewable power generation. Before retiring in early 2019, Andy led public affairs-related communications for Entergy Corporation's Northern U.S. nuclear power fleet. So, welcome, Andy. Very excited to be speaking with you.
Good morning, Tamar and Nina, and to all of our listeners at WVOX Land.
Andy, well, you seem particularly well-suited to take on a big challenge. I'd like to jump in with a very fundamental question. It's always worth making sure we're on the same page when it comes to terms and definitions. Would you please review for us exactly what disinformation is? And we see these words along with disinformation. Is it the same thing as misinformation? Is it the same thing as propaganda? Is it fake news? Can you help us with the basics?
Sure. And it is a great place to start to understand. So really, a lot of this has to do with intent of who's putting out the information. So with disinformation, you mentioned it a little earlier, it's false information deliberately and often covertly spread to influence public opinion, obscure the truth, and deceive. Misinformation, most of the time, is not intentional. It's false information as well, but it's not necessarily intentionally spread. Now, fake news is a loaded term. Some people define it as false information, which would be either misinformation or disinformation. Some of our leaders refer to fake news as to dismiss
anything
they don't like.
Andy, hold on one sec. We're coming up on a hard break, and we're going to get back to this as soon as we return from it. Sorry to interrupt, but that's how it is in news radio.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hello again and welcome back. This is Nina. I'm on the line with my co-host Tamar and our guest this morning, Disinformation News Specialist Andy Cattell. Before the break, Andy was explaining to us how disinformation, that's the word that begins with the letter D, is intentionally incorrect information that's put out into the public sphere. Misinformation, beginning with the letter M, is incorrect information, but not necessarily intentional. And Andy, we were moving on to yet another term of art, fake news.
Right, term of art might be giving it a little too much credit. So,
okay, fair enough.
To some people, the term fake news means misinformation, false information that can be deliberately spread or not intentional. But some folks in our country and around the world, including some political leaders, use the term fake news to try to dismiss accurate information that they simply do not like because it's either critical of them or their policies or of their views. So I actually do not like to use the term fake news simply because it's so vague and means different things to different people. There's another term quickly to mention, which is propaganda, usually associated with foreign influence operations from one country to another. Those of us who were around during the Cold War heard that term and were exposed to what was then called propaganda. It still very much exists, and there are several elements to that that we could discuss if we have time, but the focus on our discussion today is disinformation.
Okay, thank you. Of these terms, it seems like the act of disinformation, with the intentionality behind it, can be and has often been claimed to be a threat to our democracy. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I would completely agree with that. One of the fundamental tenets of democracy is an engaged citizenry, and an engaged citizenry that is relying on facts and true information and an accurate picture of what's going on and what policies stand for, not only in our country and the world. And our democracy is under threat, especially, I would say, in the information space, from foreign actors and a lot of domestic actors. And it has exploded because of technology. And really, if you even just look between the 2016 presidential election and the election we just went through, there was a massive increase in the amount of disinformation.
I know that there was a lot of election-related claims regarding disinformation. Beyond the election, are there news areas that get hit with disinformation?
The biggest one right now worldwide is coronavirus. There are a lot of bogus theories out there and claims about what coronavirus is, even claiming that it's a hoax, and information that is incorrect about cures, and just all kinds of things. And it's exactly the kind of issue that people with ill intent latch onto, because there's a lot of emotion involved in coronavirus, and these folks can prey on those emotions, especially the extreme emotions like fear. Instilling fear in people or playing on fear makes them more vulnerable to believe things that they ordinarily wouldn't. They suspend their judgment and rational thinking in the face of those emotions if they are manipulated in that way.
Right. Emotion can really just eradicate any clear thinking. Understood.
And the big problem I have with all this fake news is that it's reinforcing these boundaries, these political boundaries, where it's causing us to forget our shared humanity. I mean, you know, I think we need to be reminded we have more in common that divides us, and that treating people with whom we disagree with decency and respect is essential to a functioning democracy. However, the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that all speech enjoys full First Amendment protection. I'm wondering, like, what does that mean for attempts at governmental regulation? In your opinion, should there be governmental intervention?
Right. Well, it's a very tough issue, and what we have now with certain extremely powerful technology companies in the information space, such as Twitter and Facebook and Google, is a tremendous amount of control in commercial hands for the flow of information among citizens. And that didn't used to be the case to that extent. And so there are now discussions underway. There were hearings this week on Capitol Hill about increasing government regulations of such technology companies. My own point of view is that really we need to have a pretty open flow of information and have very hands-off on government regulations. We need that flow of information. It's citizen to citizen. It's government to citizens. It's governments to other citizens of other countries, etc. There should be specific limits where it's dangerous, where there's incitement to violence and that kind of thing, where literally lives could be at stake. And some of the coronavirus misinformation and disinformation definitely crosses into that category of spreading information that could harm people's health. But by and large, it should be a free flow of information. Now, what Twitter and Facebook have done is flag content that they think is false and misleading. In fewer cases, they remove it. But what they do is they put warning labels increasingly on that kind of thing. YouTube is doing it as well, and others. And that, therefore, gives the viewer or reader the option whether to continue reading to that incorrect information or not. And if they do read it, to be wary of it and maybe check it out a little further. And that should also cause the viewer or reader to be more cautious about sharing that information.
Yeah, we've seen
that. I know yesterday Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey, you know, the Facebook CEO and Twitter CEOs, told the Senate Judiciary Committee that they've been more aggressive this year than ever before in labeling misleading posts and clamping down on conspiracy theories and amplifying credible information about voting. What was your take on that?
Thank you, Daryl. We have another break coming up, so we will get back to that and a whole lot of other questions we're hoping to fit in afterwards.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. I'm Tamar Tate, and I'm here with Nina Lubin. We're speaking with Andy Cattell. And before the break, we were discussing Facebook and Twitter's defense of their election policies, the steps they took to limit election misinformation. And they testified yesterday in front of the Senate saying that they had been more aggressive this year than ever before in labeling misleading posts and clamping down on conspiracy theories and amplifying credible information about voting. And I was asking Andy whether he bought into that.
Yeah,
they
definitely have been more aggressive. A few things they did were they linked elected officials and candidates' posts to voting information from third-party independent sources. Facebook prohibited new political ads 7 days before the election and removed content that was designed to suppress voting. And they put labels, this is Facebook, suggesting that on posts suggesting that casting a ballot risks contracting, as an example. YouTube provided links to third-party fact-checking organization on some search results. And Twitter warned about synthetic and manipulated media using labels and removed what they called false or misleading information intended to undermine public confidence in an election. So they're doing a lot more, but they have to walk a fine line between protecting freedom of speech and weeding out lies that could be dangerous and destructive to our democracy.
Yeah, it seems like the Democrats on the committee were somewhat skeptical. It seems like they wanted the executive to be doing more to stamp out disinformation. I don't know what else more could they possibly do.
Yeah, again, it's hard because, you know, first of all, Facebook and others didn't start out to be journalistic-oriented operations. In other words, where they applied journalistic standards to information that was flowing on their platforms. That's not the way they started out. They weren't staffed that way. Professional journalists are trained to try to find information and decipher it and figure out what's true or false, and only then share it with their readers or viewers. And that's not the way Facebook and YouTube and Instagram, et cetera, were set up. So they have ramped up in operations there, and they're doing a lot more. But again, they just have to be really careful because of freedom of speech. And it's not an easy thing to deal with.
Right. So if the media outlets are doing evidently what they can at the moment, and they and the government are limited in what they can do to chop off speech at the legs, that leaves us. So, right. Andy, the big question, what can we, the average Joe or Jane consumer of news, do about any of this? When I look at my news feed, what do I need to be cautious about?
Right. Well, it is, in fact, the case that we are in charge of determining what's reliable information. And the key to it, we started the discussion with this, is news literacy, educating ourselves and thinking critically to judge the reliability and credibility of news reports. And I would say not just news reports, anything we see and are tempted to believe and share with others. And we face a lot of challenges. It's information overload, the desire for speed versus desire for accuracy, the blurring of the lines between entertainment and news and between news and opinion, and our own biases. We all have our own biases. So there's a lot we could do. But specifically, there are three primary questions we should ask when we are exposed to information. One, who's behind it? What are the sources of information, and are they credible? Two, what's the evidence provided? If a claim is made, for example, ballot stuffing, what's the evidence provided to back that up, if any? And three, what do other sources say about it? What do other news organizations say about it if you're only reading one? So could it be corroborated and cross-checked? And there are a whole slew of things that we could do very specifically. One is pause. We have to slow down. We live in a fast-paced world, but we have to slow down and pause before sharing so that we can think critically. Question content always, especially content that appeals to fear, anger, or partisan extremes on either side. If you're looking at a website, look closely at the website address to see if it's anything suspicious. Read beyond the headline to the full story because headlines could be misleading. So read the whole story before you like or share anything. And beware of politically framed content. So there's a lot that we can do.
What do you mean by politically framed content? Can you give an example?
Well, things that I would say appear maybe even very obviously to be ideologically oriented. Take your favorite news outlets and you can see it pretty readily if you go to the ones that are on the extremes, on the left or right.
Okay.
I'm wondering, Andy, I mean, you've been a reporter for so long. Do you believe there are any actual unbiased news sources that are out there that we could just simply read and believe, or do we just always have to be on guard whenever we read anything?
Well, we do have to be on guard, but there are things that can help us. For one thing, there are fact-checking operations, some of whom are independent, so I'll mention a few here. PolitiFact.com, Snopes, SNOPES.com, FactCheck.org, and then you have traditional news organizations that have carved out in their operations specific fact-checking teams. So the Washington Post has one, for example. The Associated Press has one, my alma mater. And for images, you can go to a site called TinEye, T-I-N-E-Y-E. So it's TinEye.com. So you plug in the image there, regardless of its source, and it will search the entire Internet and try to tell you whether it's an accurate information or accurate image or has been doctored. Now, specifically about news organizations, you've got some researchers who have done some studies on this. And if you go on, if everyone who's listening, if you go on the League of Women Voters of Westchester's website, you will see some resources there, including a chart that depicts media bias. So it's lwvw.org, League of Women Voters of Westchester. Okay, so on the center, you have news organizations that have high accuracy and are in the center politically. So my alma mater, which was a news wire service news agency, is in there, the Associated Press, and you have their competitors. So Reuters and Bloomberg, for example. They are right in the center, meaning they're high accuracy and in the center politically, or trying to be. And BBC is on there on broadcast. On the extremes, you have Fox to the right with a little lower credibility, and InfoWars and The Blaze is on there, and Daily Caller. And then on the left, something called the Palmer Report, Truth Out. And MSNBC falls in there actually to the left and kind of not exactly the most accurate from an information perspective. So you could disagree with the way these news organizations that I mentioned have been placed, but at least this chart that I'm mentioning that's on the League's website, developed by another organization, is a start.
Okay, so I think it's worth asking, how are they placed? Is it a matter of how many inaccuracies are counted up in each of these newspapers or outlets? I guess I'm asking your question, like, okay, who's behind it? You know,
right.
How are we doing this?
Right. Well, there's a lot. It's not easy, okay? So someone has to make judgments, and judgment calls other people might not agree with, but this particular organization, it's on mediabiaschart.com.
Okay.
You can look at their methodology. But they do study articles or broadcasts from these operations and rank them about accuracy and
okay.
where they are ideologically, left or right.
Okay, thank you. Mediabiaschart.com.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we're heading to another break soon, but I think it's important to repeat, if you don't mind, the resources out there on the web for the written word, for the images. Can you mention them again?
Yes, sure. PolitiFact, Nopes, factcheck.org, Washington Post, TinEye. And when I didn't mention, mediabiasfactcheck.com.
Okay, and now we'll take our break. Thanks.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. I'm Tamar Tate. I'm here with Nina Lubin, and we're speaking with Andy Cattell about disinformation. And Andy was telling us before the break about unbiased news sources. He was giving us some pointers on how we can guide ourselves to real news. Andy, I'm curious, what do you read on a regular basis?
I'm a really big news consumer. I actually spend several hours a day. And the key for all of us is to have a healthy news diet. And what do I mean by that? It's kind of like a well-balanced, nutritious meal. It means sometimes you want to eat things that are not good for you, but you do anyway. And you also tend to eat, I hope, things that are nutritious and good for you. So in the news sense, you have to expose yourself to information from sources that you may not like. Occasionally, you don't have to do it all the time. But in order to understand the other side or sides, you've got to do that. So in my case, I have a mixture of both broadcast and online, and I also highly recommend that. Those of us who rely primarily on social media or television or radio are doing ourselves a disservice, because those forms of information conveyance have their limitations. So you really need to mix that up a bit as well to be healthy in the news sense. So specifically, I read Fox News. I tune in occasionally to Fox News on cable television, both the business channel and the main news channel. I would say I do not watch or read Fox as much as the following ones, which are the New York Times, the Associated Press, LoHUD, which is the Journal News, our local print and online news operation, and the Washington Post. And I also am a subscriber to the Wall Street Journal. I do also supplement all of that looking at Google News. They aggregate information from a lot of other sources, and this one will come out of left field to maybe most of our listeners, but I watch Russian state television news every single day, 1 hour, every single day. That's partially an outgrowth of my journalism background, being a foreign correspondent at one time in the Soviet Union.
And you're fluent in Russian?
Is that
in English or Russian?
I watch it in Russian. I should point out that they do translate a lot of their materials online. I'm talking about Russian state television news and also other Russian news operations that are primarily run by the government of Russia. So you have to take everything you watch or read with a big grain of salt there. And so that's the way I do it. I check everything I hear that interests me on Russian state television news. Why do I do it? I mean, first of all, I'm just interested in Russian matters and what I have a lot of Russian friends, and I go visit there occasionally still, just for the heck of it, not for professional reasons. But I try to keep up my Russian language skills, so it's helpful for that as well.
So I know Trump a while back had a conversation with Putin about what he, I know you don't like the term, but he uses the term fake news. And he said to Putin, you know, you don't have this problem in Russia, but we do in the United States. And Putin said, no, we also have it. It's the same. I thought that everything was state regulated in terms of news in Russia. Is that not the case?
There are some small pockets of independent news organizations in Russia, some of which, interestingly, are based in neighboring countries such as the Baltics, but feed their information back into Russia. And they do that because they can have a freer hand in their funding sources and the way they run their operations by being based outside of Russia. But it's a very tough environment in Russia for citizens to get accurate information and unbiased information and even information that is not in line with the government, because the government does control the airwaves and is trying very hard to control the internet and the flow of information very broadly. And there are some new laws that are pending in Russia that will impose even more restrictions on true journalism. And sadly, journalism has been independent journalists, crusading journalists, have been literally under attack in Russia for years. Several have been killed. Several have been jailed. It's kind of a sad situation. And, you know, however bad it is in this country, you can think about authoritarian countries such as Russia, and realize that they have an even more difficult time, the citizens, to digest information and find accurate information.
Of course, the internet must be a great assist to people that have views contrary to the government. Of course, unless the government has shut it down, I don't know.
Right. Well, the internet, you know, is a mixed blessing for everyone in the whole planet, because it enables all of us to share information with everyone else in mass form. You know, things can become viral. The problem is that some of that information is not true and it's dangerous. And most of us, most of the public, are not trained journalists, not trained to determine what's true or false. And we just share things very readily, which may not be true. And by doing so, you could be compounding the problem.
That's
which
right.
comes back to what I said earlier, pause before sharing
right.
and check it out first.
Hitting that share button is like almost second nature. As soon as you read a headline, boom, you know, there it goes. And one of the things we have...
Yeah, and the problem is if you get something shared by someone in your community, you tend to believe it more, whether it's true or not.
Right. It's, you know, talk about friendship, you know, Facebook friendship, et cetera. The reason we have friends, some of the people we have as friends, that relationship is based a lot on trust. We like a lot of the same things, and we trust each other. So if one of your friends shares a piece of information using social media with you, you tend to believe that because they're your friend.
Right.
You may even assume that they checked it out first. Well, all of those things, you may still love them, but... maybe love them even more by suggesting that they check things out first before sharing it with you or anyone else.
Right.
And I think that also contributes to the extreme polarization that we're seeing in this country because our friends on Facebook tend to share our own opinions, and so the things they're sharing most likely correspond to the way we feel about something, in which case we're sort of just perpetuating this echo chamber where we're constantly hearing the same opinions. And we're not getting what you said, that nutritious diet of news opinions from all different sides across the spectrum.
I like that idea, Andy. I'm going to follow it. I'm going to try to make my news digestion a little bit more varied. And use that variety regularly, and we'll report back to our listeners. Andy, before we go, what you are doing and the information that you are transmitting is very, very important. And I also know that you do presentations that really lend themselves to online education and learning. If there are any teachers... or other organizations that would like to have you come and really go make a much deeper dive into all of these things we've talked about, including how we exactly arm ourselves with tools and resources, can they contact you?
Yeah, absolutely. League of Women Voters of Westchester's website, lwvw.org, is one way. More directly, I am on LinkedIn and Facebook, for example. Happy to... get the word out to students and anyone else. I did in New Rochelle a few weeks ago a session just before the election on election disinformation to an adult learning group associated with Iona College. So happy to do more of that and with younger students as well.
Right. The ones that are really on online, right?
Yeah.
The high school maybe age. So, okay. So, that's absolutely helpful. You remind me of my own high school experience. I think it was high school English. The lesson, the subheading was critical reading. You know, there was no internet, but we really were asked to read, to stop, and then to ask questions very similar to what you've posed for us. Who wrote it? What evidence was there to support the thesis statement? And how have people responded to it? Who likes it? Who doesn't like it? Those kinds of things. So it's really kind of timeless, this sense of being a critical observer. So thank you for this morning. I know you have a lot more to explain, and I hope that people will take you up on my offer for them to contact you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners for joining us today. We wish everyone a happy and healthy Thanksgiving holiday. And remember to join us for the next Ballot Box on Wednesday, December 16th.
Bye-bye, everyone.